watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as
we you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, or WZKW Kingsville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. That famous paragraph from the Declaration of Independence, which is celebrated on July 4th, is not the law of this land, though doubtless some people believe that it is. The law of this land is the U.S. Constitution, which does not guarantee life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness, does not guarantee every person the means to feed and house themselves, and does not guarantee the right to abolish the government, quite the opposite. And it grows more corrupt and tyrannical with each passing day. And over these more than two centuries, every time the people have fought for basic dignity and livelihood in this country, the guns of the government, the clubs of the government, have protected the tyranny of the men of property against the needs and dignity of the many. And this is no accident. As it is, 55 rich white men designated what the rule of law would be at the Constitutional Convention. They followed the idea articulated by New York delegate John Jay that the men who own the country ought to run it. It is only when popular anger has reached the level of rebellion that the rights of the people have expanded vis-a-vis the interests of the capitalist class. Our vaunted Bill of Rights are suspended when we enter into that modern form of slavery known as employment. No free speech, no freedom from invasive searches, no freedom of association, no freedom to organize, to redress grievances. There is no meaningful freedom of the press when the majority of mass media space is allocated by law to corporations for their profit-making activities, where their free speech rights include the repetitive propagation of lies, suppression of important information, and the ability to silence or marginalize those who wish to challenge the state and corporate power. We are relegated to little spaces on the margins, such as this one, which I am grateful to occupy. So basically, after all these 200-plus years, citizens who wish to challenge the way resources and decision-making power are allocated still face arrest, imprisonment, beating, surveillance, and criminalization, albeit somewhat less than under the rule of King George in 1776. That said, the speaker on tonight's program is a great believer in the U.S. Constitution and the rule of law. He describes himself as a lifelong conservative Republican, a Christian, a former U.S. Marine major who worked in intelligence during the first Gulf War in Iraq and who subsequently worked as a chief UN's weapons inspector in Iraq in the 1990s. He is brave, brilliant, and honest, a person who I deeply respect, even if I don't share many of his basic beliefs, and even if he equates anarchy with chaos, as he does repeatedly in the speech you'll hear next. If you haven't guessed it by now, he's Scott Ritter, and he has some serious things to say about the Bush administration's war against Iran that has surreptitiously begun. Citizenship versus consumerism, and the dark and dangerous time facing the country that calls upon every American to know where they stand and to stand there. This isn't happy talk, yet I found it strangely hopeful because of Scott Ritter himself. A conservative Christian ex-Marine is normally not the sort of person I would expect to be on my team against a government that I can only feel is the enemy of liberty, even as it proclaims the word at every turn. The very fact that Ritter has made this journey gives me hope that there are many more in America who call themselves conservatives, who will come forward as courageous and principled allies in the struggle ahead. Ritter was once a darling of the right-wing media yammerfest because he criticized the Clinton administration and talked tough to the Saddam Hussein regime. But when Ritter challenged the Bush administration, he went from media darling to persona non grata. The talk we're about to hear was delivered on June 23rd at the Trap Rock Peace Center in Deerfield, Massachusetts. Scott Ritter.
Yeah, I wish there was a better reason for being here. I wish that, in fact, what we were going through tonight is a discussion of history, to talk about, you know, an unpleasant past and, you know, what we learned from the events of the past and how we're moving forward boldly to improve ourselves as a community, as a people, as a nation. Unfortunately, we're here not to talk about good things. We're here to talk about, at least I'm here to talk about bad things. And maybe from bad we can have a discussion of what good we can do. But we're confronted with two facts that we can't escape. One is that we, as we speak, are engaged in war in Iraq. It doesn't matter if you agree on how we went to war or we didn't get to war. You know, that debate can be conducted numerous times. The fact is we're at war in Iraq. But the other fact, and I think most Americans accept the fact that we're at war. Even if you're against the war, you accept the fact that we're at war in Iraq. But the second fact, which most Americans, it might not even enter their mind, we're at war with Iran today. The United States is waging two major wars in the same theater of operations. One war the American people have come to accept, not agree with, but accept that it is occurring. But the second war, the war with Iran, many Americans would be stunned by that statement that we are at war with Iran. They would say, well, wait a minute, the president hasn't declared war, the president hasn't said anything, but Congress hasn't talked about this, there hasn't been a national debate on this subject. How could we be at war with Iran? It's absurd. You've gone over the top, Mr. Ritter. You've lost your marbles. We no longer, you know, can respect what you have to say. So before I talk about Iran, let me go back to talk about Iraq. I'm on safe ground with Iraq, I think. What I'll remind you with Iraq is that if you ask most Americans, when did the war with Iraq start? Let's say 19 March 2003, when the President of the United States got on national television and told us that he was ordering American troops over the border. That's when the war with Iraq started. But we got this uncomfortable thing that's just come out called the Downing Street Memo. The Downing Street Memo is an interesting document. It's a report from the head of British intelligence to the Prime Minister and his inner circle on a meeting that took place in the United States in July of 2002. This British official, Mr. Dearlove, C, as they call it, if you've, you know, the British don't like to name their intelligence officials, so as soon as you become the director of MI6, you lose your name and you become C. So C tells the British officials that the United States, that the Bush administration has already committed to war with Iraq. The decision has been made to go to war with Iraq, and that they are now trying to fix intelligence around that policy, meaning that they need to fabricate an excuse for war. The excuse for war will be around the notion of Saddam Hussein possessing weapons of mass destruction and having links with al-Qaeda, the forces of international terror. These aren't facts. These are excuses. So intelligence will be fixed around this. We will fabricate intelligence to create the perception of these two excuses so that we can go to war. Now, some people say, well, all right, but that's just the decision to go to war. We still only went to war in March 2003. There's a couple more documents that people need to reflect on. One is a covert finding signed by the president in spring 2002, which authorized the Central Intelligence Agency and the U.S. Department of Defense Special Operations personnel to carry out strategic reconnaissance and direct action operations inside Iraq for the purpose of regime change. This is a decision made by the president to engage forces of the United States, intelligence community, and Department of Defense in warlike actions inside Iraq. Spring 2002. Remember, the president was saying in September 2002, October 2002, that he has not made a decision to go to war. In fact, he stood before the United Nations and said, "I am firmly committed to a peaceful settlement of the problem with Iraq. That's why I'm going to the United Nations to seek a diplomatic route. I do not want war," the president said. Well, he lied. He'd already ordered America to war in the spring of 2002. A few days after his presentation to the United Nations, the president ordered a massive airstrike, a massive air campaign to begin against Iraq. The initial strike was over 100 aircraft, British and American aircraft, going in, striking targets that had nothing to do with defending the no-fly zone. The purpose of these strikes was to interdict Iraq's air defense system, to nullify their command and control, and to pave the way for the insertion of American Special Operations Forces. American combat troops entered Iraq in September 2002. Not airplanes, ground troops, special forces, engaged in warlike actions inside Iraq. Ladies and gentlemen, the ground war started in September 2002, not March 2003. Now, it's funny because on October 16th, 2002, the president stood before the United States Congress after they had voted a war powers resolution giving him authority to commit American troops to war, and he said, "I have not committed to a war with Iraq." Now, if you ever had evidence of a lie, a president misleading the American people and misleading the Congress of the United States, there it is in black and white, his October 16th speech. That alone is enough to talk about opening up an investigation into initiating articles of impeachment. It boggles the mind that nobody has picked up on this fact. The media tends to ignore it. But nobody here seems to be shocked if now, I hope, that I've made the case that the war with Iraq actually began many months before the president declared war, that we were engaged in active combat operations with Iraq as early as September 2002. And most people say, well, the fact is most people have the same reaction that the news media has had about the Downing Street memo. There's nothing new in that. I mean, if you listen to the New York Times, the Washington Post, and you can't listen to them, you read them, and listen to CBS News, ABC News, NBC News, they'll say, well, the reason why we're not given too much coverage of the Downing Street memo, they're not attacking the credence of the document. They're not saying it's a false document. They can't. It's an official British government document. Classified secret, UK eyes only, meaning only the British government's allowed to see this thing. Well, somebody leaked it. Now the whole world gets to see it. Nobody's calling it a fake document. They're just saying it's not newsworthy. It's not newsworthy because it's old news. Andrea Mitchell, senior foreign correspondent for NBC News, when asked about the Downing Street memo, said, "Anybody in the summer of 2002 who didn't know that President Bush was committed to a war with Iraq had to be deaf, dumb, and blind." Well, excuse me, Andrea, then why weren't you in the summer of 2002, you and your colleagues, continuing to raise your hand every time the president says something about a diplomatic op, saying, "So, excuse me, Mr. President, but in fact, haven't you committed to a war with Iraq?" I mean, if the news media is saying that everybody knew it in the summer of 2002, and that's why it's not news today, then the news media is complicit in this entire effort because the news media didn't do its job to ask the question, to demand the answers. The news media just went along for the ride, and that's what happened. But now the news media is trying to cover up their failure by committing another failure, saying, well, it's not news today because we knew it in 2002. Now let's go to Iran. What do we know today? What do we know? We know that the Iranian government has demarched the United States about overflights of Iranian territory by unmanned aerial drones. Demarsh sent a protest, a diplomatic protest, saying, hey, your stuff's flying over our territory. Stop it. It's a sovereign state. We own this air over our land. You can't fly over and take pictures of our national security targets, or national security sites. Imagine if Cuba has a grudge against the United States, a little concerned about a little American buildup in Florida, start flying airplanes over Florida airspace taking pictures. What would America do? We'd shoot their planes down, and then we'd bomb the airfields that their planes took up on, and no one could argue against it because Cuba committed an act of war by overflying our territory. The United States is overflying Iranian airspace as we speak. It's an act of war. The Iranians have reported on it. The Iranians have said, we will not shoot down your planes because we don't want to give you an excuse to attack us. But the fact is, this is occurring, and the media is not reporting it. If they do report it, it appears in some paragraph stuck in the middle of a story buried on page A21. One time, comment, let go. We know the Iranian government has demarched, sent an official diplomatic protest to the Afghanistan government about a large covert operations base run in western Afghanistan by the CIA and American Special Operations Forces. The Iranians know the base exists. The Iranians know that the base is being used to infiltrate operatives into Iran. Again, imagine if Mexico allowed the Cubans to put a large military covert operations base in Sonora and infiltrate operatives who are spying on America. What would we do if we knew that base existed? We'd declare the right of imminent self-defense. We'd launch a preemptive strike and destroy the base. The Iranians know the United States is doing this in Afghanistan, and they've reported it, and the news media has picked it up, buried it in page A22 in a little paragraph, one time mention. That's it. How many people know that at the same time that Donald Rumsfeld made his surprise visit to Iraq about a month and a half ago, where he went right after he visited Iraq? Azerbaijan. Anybody wonder why he went to Azerbaijan? How many people here know that the United States Army has run major war games in the spring of 2005 about the deployment of multi-divisional sized forces into Azerbaijan? As we speak, American war planners are talking about how we can deploy troops to Azerbaijan, what air force bases, air bases we're going to use, how we can build up logistical supplies, how we're going to operate in that theater. Why would we want to go to Azerbaijan? Well, when you look at the Cold War plans of how we plan to deal with Iran if the Soviet Union ever crossed over into the border, we were going to launch Marines into two little coastal towns in the Persian Gulf, Chabahar and Bandar Abbas. Then we would build up these forces, and then we would slog our way across thousands of kilometers of mountainous desert towards Tehran. A very difficult fight. A lot of people today, when we talk about Iran, say, well, we don't have enough troops to do that. We got 140,000 troops stuck in Iraq. Our army's, spread too thin. We've already drawn down the National Guard and Reserve as much as we can. We don't have enough troops to invade and occupy Iran. And you're right. But the military planners aren't talking about invading and occupying Iran. Look at a map. Look at Azerbaijan. Take your finger and go from the border of Azerbaijan and Iran and see how close Tehran is. It's just a short thrust down the Caspian Coastal Highway, for you can have a number of American divisions right on the outskirts of Tehran. And that is the plan we are engaged in right now. The U.S. Army is planning this as we speak. Major war games have been conducted, supervised at the highest levels. Ladies and gentlemen, the war with Iran has already begun. However you want to define war, it hasn't been large-scale conventional conflict, but pre-conflict preparations are definitely underway, and warlike advance force operations are underway. The CIA is working in Iraq as we speak with a group known as the Mujahideen al-Khalq, the MEK. The MEK first came to prominence, if you want to say that, in 1979. They were the Iranians that took over the U.S. Embassy. They're the guys that took our people hostage and held our people hostage. But they had a falling out with the Islamic fundamentalists. And the MEK left Iran and went across the border during the Iran-Iraq War and joined forces with Iraq. The MEK, a force of 20,000 to 30,000 fighters, became Directorate M-19 of the Iraqi Intelligence Service, of the Mukhabarat. Saddam Hussein funded the MEK. The MEK was trained by Directorate M-16, Directorate M-21, Directorate M-4. These are all covert operations units of the Iraqi Intelligence Service trained in explosive assassination, roadside bombs. Now, the same guys that trained the MEK today are fighting the United States. The IEDs, the improvised explosive devices that are being used, the bombs, the terror tactics, are all things that the forces of Saddam Hussein, his intelligence operatives, learned and taught. It's their tradecraft. They're being used to kill American soldiers today. Well, the students of these Iraqi intelligence assassins were the MEK. The State Department of the United States has classified the MEK as a terrorist organization. A terrorist organization. On the same page with Al-Qaeda. On the same page with Hamas. And other groups that are well known for carrying out acts of terror around the world. What is the CIA doing? Well, in April of 2003, a month after we invaded, the United States Department of Defense sent Delta Force, American Special Operators, to the MEK bases throughout Iraq and negotiated a disarmament where they laid down their arms and they stayed on their bases. Then the Department of Defense withdrew and the CIA came in. The CIA took responsibility for paying these people, for feeding these people, for clothing these people, for training these people, and for dispatching these people into Iran to carry out acts of terror. 2 weeks ago, you probably heard about bombs going off in southern Iran in the lead up to the national elections. I believe 8 people were killed. The bombs were planted by agents of the MEK operating out of CIA-controlled bases in Iraq. Ladies and gentlemen, what does this make the United States of America? We're waging a global war on terror against the practitioners of terror, against people who hijacked 4 airplanes and flew them into buildings in the United States, killed nearly 3,000 of our citizens. We were all enraged by this. It was a crime of horrific proportions, and we have a right to be enraged. But how enraged are we that our own officials who were paid for by our taxpayer dollars, who took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States of America, are defiling the reputation of this country by engaging in the exact same tactics. The exact same tactics. It doesn't matter whether you kill 8 or 3,000. An act of terror is an act of terror. And the United States today, as we speak, is a terrorist state for allowing this to occur. But it's not just an act of terror, ladies and gentlemen. It's an act of war. What did we say after September 11th? That our nation was attacked. It didn't matter that it was a non-nation state that did this. That's why we are engaged in the global war on terror. We declared war on terror. We declared war on those who practice terror. Well, what are we going to do? Declare war on ourselves? Because we're guilty of the same crime. We're guilty of an act of war. America is at war with Iran. There could be no doubt about this. NBC News, ABC News, CBS News might say that it was common knowledge in 2002 that the United States had embraced a policy of regime change regarding Iraq. And that's why a memo today that confirms this is not newsworthy. But how many news directors will admit that it's common knowledge that the Bush administration has embraced a policy of regime change in Iran? Because that is the policy of the Bush administration. The president and his officials may stand up and say that they are embarked on a diplomatic route to achieve a peaceful resolution of the problem of Iran. But this is wrong. The president has one policy and one policy only, and that is the removal of the regime of the mullahs in Tehran and replacing the regime of the mullahs with an American anointed alternative. Now, there's some code words that the president uses when he talks about this. As the people of Iran go, he said, the people of America will support. The president has made speeches, the State of the Union address, and others, where he has encouraged the people of Iran to solve the problem on their own, to rise up and remove the mullahs. But we know that that's not going to happen without a little nudge. And we got to give them a little nudge. But what's our excuse for giving them a nudge? Liberty and democracy? Sounds nice, but the international community won't buy into that one. No, we need a threat. Just like with Iraq and Saddam Hussein, we had to have a threat. We had a policy of regime change, and we had to fix the intelligence to support the policy. So we fabricated information about massive stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction. We fabricated information about a link between Saddam Hussein and the forces of al-Qaeda. Today, we all know that this was wrong. The administration admits it was wrong. They don't admit to deliberately misleading. They say, well, we were mistaken. It was bad intelligence. Well, what are some of the patterns of bad intelligence that we can draw on? A gentleman named Curveball, an Iraqi defector owned and operated by Ahmed Chalabi, who was given the United States, turned over to Germany, given a lot of beer, and then we debriefed him. And he had fantasies about mobile biological weapons labs that prompted Colin Powell to appear before the Security Council of the United Nations with drawings, detailed drawings. How can a drunk man come up with that? I don't know. But detailed drawings of mobile biological labs, not just trucks, but rail cars with biological weapons laboratories buried inside. And he said, this is fact. This is fact. We now know that they never existed. It wasn't fact. It was fabrication. And the CIA knew it was fabrication when they reported it. But because we weren't about telling the truth, because we were about fixing intelligence to the policy, everybody went along with it. The same with the Niger yellow cake. The same with the concept of Hussein Kamal, the son-in-law of Saddam Hussein. You had Dick Cheney appear before the Veterans of Foreign Wars in August of 2002 and say that we know Saddam has reactivated his nuclear weapons program from defectors such as the son-in-law of Saddam Hussein. Now, the vice president's making a statement. He's giving us information, and he's telling us where he got the information from, the defection of the son-in-law of Saddam Hussein. Excuse me, Mr. Vice President. I happen to have been the UN official who led the investigation into that defection. Not only have I talked with everybody who has debriefed him, including the UN officials, the Jordanian representative of the king who sat in on every debriefing, the CIA operatives who debriefed him, and the MI6 operative who debriefed him, I've spoken with the other Iraqis who have defected with Hussein Kamal and knew what he said. Hussein Kamal never said that Iraq had reactivated its nuclear weapons program. In fact, he said the exact opposite. Over and over and over again throughout his debriefings, he said, there are no more weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I personally have ordered the destruction of all chemical weapons, biological weapons, nuclear weapons, and long-range ballistic missiles. I've ordered the dismantling of every production facility in Iraq related to this. We're not producing this stuff anymore, is what he said. So either Dick Cheney read these documents and knowingly misrepresented the data, or a CIA official briefed Dick Cheney on material that didn't exist in these documents. One way or the other, the Vice President of the United States told a lie in August of 2002, and he's never been called on it. Never been called on it. But the media knows all this. But it's not news. It's not news. You know what else the media knows today? They know the Bush administration is fabricating an excuse for war with Iran. What is that excuse? The Iranian nuclear weapons program. We've been told over and over again that Iran has a nuclear weapons program. John Bolton, and you're allowed to hiss when I say his name, John Bolton, the potential future, he will be the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations because George Bush doesn't give a damn about democracy or the will of the Senate, and George Bush will appoint John Bolton during a recess, give him a year and a half to wage havoc. John Bolton, when he traveled to the Soviet Union, I'm an old Cold Warrior, so I still think of the Soviet Union. When he got off the plane in Moscow, first thing he said to his Russian counterparts is, there can be no doubt that Iran has a nuclear weapons program. I always love that term, there can be no doubt. It's something that Donald Rumsfeld, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, George Bush, everybody said about Saddam Hussein and his WMD programs. There can be no doubt that Saddam Hussein today possesses weapons of mass destruction. Well, now we have every reason to doubt that. In fact, as we know, there can be no doubt that he didn't have it. Even the CIA acknowledges this today. So I get a little leery when I hear government officials from this administration say, there can be no doubt that Iran has a nuclear weapons program. Well, there actually is a lot of reason to doubt it. What is the key intelligence behind the U.S. claims of an Iranian nuclear weapons program? Defector information. And wait, it gets better. What organization runs the defectors that are reporting this? The MEK. The MEK, whose survival, not only as an organization, but as individuals, is dependent upon the CIA. if the MEK were disbanded and sent back to Iran, as they should be, their lives would be forfeit. If the MEK was released into Iraq, their lives would be forfeit. The only way the MEK can survive is by doing the CIA's bidding. The president needed information to sustain the notion that Iran had a nuclear weapons program. The MEK provided it, the CIA reported it, and the American media parroted it. And now everybody who's read newspapers, who's watched the evening news, is under the impression that Iran has a nuclear weapons program. And you know, when you read the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA inspector reports coming out, they'll tell you that Iran has a nuclear centrifuge enrichment program. Ooh, that sounds really bad. I mean, isn't that what we said about the Iraqis? Those aluminum tubes were to build centrifuges for a nuclear weapons program. Well, the Iraqis did have a nuclear weapons program. So if those tubes had, in fact, been for centrifuges, you might be able to say that they were being used for a weapons program. But the only evidence we have, besides the MEK's data, that there is a nuclear weapons program, you cite it back. You know, you hear this statement, you try and trace it back. Where's the proof? Where's the evidence? And it all boils down to one thing. Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, the president, everybody says, Iran is a nation awash in a sea of oil. There can be no viable justification for the Iranians to seek a nuclear energy program. It's absurd. Therefore, the only reason they could be pursuing this centrifuge enrichment program is for a nuclear weapons program. Sounds impressive. And your average American on the street will go, yeah, or hell yeah, or get her done, or something like that. But the fact is, ladies and gentlemen, wait. Let's hit that rewind button and go back to 1976. During the Ford administration, when the Secretary of Defense was Donald Rumsfeld, when the White House Chief of Staff was Dick Cheney, the Shah of Iran, yes, he's not a mad mullah, but he is the leader of a nation awash in a sea of oil. The Shah of Iran petitions the United States and says, Iran needs a nuclear energy program. Iran cannot be held hostage to the vagaries of regional and international conflict. If there is a war in the Middle East, the Straits of Hormuz will be cut off. Iran will not be able to ship its oil. If there is a war, our oil fields might be bombed. We might not be able to produce the oil we need for energy. The Soviet Union looms on our border. And we are a good American ally. We need a nuclear energy program, not just a nuclear energy program, but the complete cycle, because Iran cannot be held hostage to a supply of enriched uranium from Europe during a time of war. Iran must have the entire cycle. And President Ford and Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, and Dick Cheney, the White House Chief of Staff, said, yeah, this is a good idea. It makes sense for Iran to have a nuclear energy program, the complete cycle. And they initiated a process in which Iran would have this nuclear energy program. Of course, the Shah didn't last as long as they had wanted. He left in 79. The mad mullahs came in. But did the strategic imperative that the Iranians held close, the need for an alternative to oil, continue to exist? Oh, yeah, especially after an 8-year war with Iraq, in which the Iranians found themselves not only subjected to warfare, Iraqi invasion of the southern oil field producing areas, Iraqi bombardment of refineries and oil transshipment points, but also an international embargo imposed by the United States. Suddenly, a nation awash in a sea of oil wasn't as secure as one might be led to believe. The Iranian government said, we need this nuclear energy program now more than ever if we are to survive as a modern nation state. Now, let me emphasize it, a modern nation state. We Americans live today with a lifestyle that is unimaginable in many parts of the world. We take it for granted. But what makes this lifestyle click along? Energy, energy, energy. Whether it's oil energy, coal-based energy, nuclear energy, wherever, energy. You got to have energy. And it's got to be constant. There can't be gaps in energy. You know, look what happened when the lights went out in New York City. the kind of economic hit we took. You just shut down the electric grid on the East Coast, and man, this country has some major issues. Energy, energy, energy. Why would we feel that we have the right to deny any nation state on the face of the earth access to energy, knowing that we are addicted to energy? The Iranians want a lifestyle like ours. When they walk down the streets of Tehran, they want lights on. They want cars functioning. They want air conditioning going. They want access to the same things we want. It's not about building nuclear bombs to destroy the world. It's about living in modern society. Life. Just the basic aspect of life. And they recognize, especially today, with the United States talking about imposing a stringent economic embargo on the Iranian sale of oil, after watching an economic embargo against their neighbor, Iraq, destroy that nation over the course of a decade, the Iranians recognize that in order to survive as a nation state, not just a modern nation state, they have to have this alternative energy supply. And they're seeking it. They're moving forward with it. The world said you can't have it. So they went secretly and got it. And they lied and they misled and they did all the bad things. But the bottom line is, at the end of the day, what exists in Iran is a nuclear energy program, not a nuclear weapons program. And everyone in the Bush administration knows this. Just as they knew that Saddam Hussein did not possess massive stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction when they said he did, they know Iran does not possess a nuclear weapons program. They know it is an energy program. And the media knows this as well. I'm really fearful that someday, 3 to 4 years from now, a document will emerge that talks about that the president and the Bush administration was fixing intelligence around the policy of regime change, and that everybody, especially Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, who approved the original Iranian nuclear energy program in 1976, was saying in 2005 that, yeah, we know there's not a nuclear weapons program, but we have to fix the intelligence around the policy. And the media will go, well, that's old news. It's not newsworthy. Because we all, the media, knew about this in the summer of 2005. Well, then why isn't the media reporting it? Oh, yes, the Washington Post will claim that they report they actually broke the story about the Ford administration. The Washington Post ran an article. They buried it, ran it one day, never got picked up by anybody. It's disappeared. The runaway bride, however, she will never go away. You know, she's ran off, and she's captured the hearts and imagination of America. NBC did a major interview with her. The whole world watched. Now there's going to be a made-for-TV movie. She's got a book deal. And the runaway bride will be just branded into the mindset of America. But Iran's nuclear energy program? No. We're going to forget about it. The media that knows that there's only a nuclear energy program in Iran will forever repeat. Every time the Bush administration says Iranian nuclear weapons program, they'll parrot it. They'll parrot it. Now, what's the implication of all this? A, I'm stating fact. We are at war with Iran as we speak. B, the president has made a decision, and he will not back away from this decision, that we are removing the mad mullahs in Tehran. C, the excuse will be the Iranian nuclear weapons program. That isn't. The methodology, precondition the American public, that's already been done. We've been pre-programmed to accept at face value anything derogatory that's published about the Iranians. The Iranians just had an election. It's not a perfect election. Hell, what election is? Ours wasn't. But they had an election. And it was a democratic election for parliament. And they had heated debate, heated discussion. They have two candidates that are going at it tooth and nail. Who knows who's going to win? We still don't know who's going to win. They have a runoff election taking place in Iran. Bush administration has dismissed this election as a charade, a sham. It's not real. It's not democracy. It's not democratic. The New York Times has run an editorial that, again, condemns this election process. The New York Times has allowed Daniel Pletka, the vice president of the American Enterprise Institute, i.e. mouthpiece of the projects of the New American Century, to run an op-ed piece on the pages of the New York Times, giving her instant credibility in the mindset of all the sheep in America who read the New York Times and accept what it says at face value, that this was a sham. Well, I'll tell you what, the kind of sham that was run in Iran has not been run in Egypt, has not been run in Pakistan, has not been running Saudi Arabia, has not been running Jordan. And yet these are American allies engaged in the global war on terror, the fight for liberty and democracy. And yet when the Iranians actually implement homegrown democracy, it's not American democracy, it's not Jeffersonian democracy, but I'll tell you what, it's Iranian democracy, and it's working. The Iranians are debating, they're discussing, and they're electing people who are representative of majority thought. Now, the tragedy is, the one man who was truly representative of majority thought, a moderate-leaning man named Rafsanjani, might lose this election. Why? Because of the interference of the United States. Rafsanjani talks about the need for a moderate policy of engagement with the United States. We have to accept that these lunatics are in Washington, D.C. We just sort of have to surf through this thing and we'll get out of it as best we can. Be tolerant of America. But because we've come out and condemned the process, because we're talking about regime change, we've hyped up the rhetoric in Iran so much that a conservative who will be against all reform in Iran has a good chance of being elected. Now, what's that say about American involvement in the processes of democracy globally?
Breaking in here, since this talk was given, our speaker, Scott Ritter, was proven correct. The religious conservative candidate, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, was elected president in what the Western media generally termed a stunning upset.
Pardon?
Business as usual.
Well, yeah, but the point is, usually we try and do it in the shadows. Right now, we're just right out front about it. The lie is right there. We condemn democracy, and yet we pervert democracy at the same time. It's what we did in Iraq. Remember the Purple Finger Revolution? You know, all the people who went to the polls and voted and dipped their finger in purple ink, and then they came over, and you had that lady hold up her purple finger during the State of the Union address, and all the congressmen held up, and all their representatives held up, and everybody's pointing purple fingers in the air. That was a sham. That wasn't an election. That was a selection. That was an American-controlled process that is dying on the vine. There is no political process in Iraq today worthy of the term. There is chaos. There is anarchy. There is a civil war brewing. There's a split, a divide between the Sunni and Shia and Kurds that's only deepened because of American involvement. But if you listen to the American media, great progress is being made in Iraq. And the thing they point to most of all to cite great progress is the election, the role democracy has played in Iraq. What a joke. At least the Iranians who voted last week knew who they were voting for. The Iraqis didn't know who they were voting for. They had these giant slates of candidates who couldn't even announce their candidacy out of fear of being assassinated. Is that election? Is that democracy? No, but they dipped their fingers in purple ink. And even the left today, the progressive left in America, is afraid to be critical of that process out of fear of being called anti-democratic. The fact of the matter, ladies and gentlemen, is that we, the people of the United States of America, have been lied to and are being lied to today about events that will have a traumatic and dramatic impact on who we are and what we are as a people for years to come, if not decades to come. I'll get to questions in just a second. We are in a process right now from which there is no elegant solution. There is no magic snapping of the fingers. We cannot undo what has been done. This is my own personal opinion. You're welcome to disagree. But right now, we have people who say, what can we do? And when they say that, what they're really saying is, what can we do to affect change now? Nothing. There's not a thing you can do to affect change now. The peace movement failed. And all you have to do is look at the fact that we're at war in Iraq today to understand the depth and the magnitude of that failure. The peace movement, for all of its good intentions, did not succeed. It didn't even come close to succeeding. There were massive demonstrations. Hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people went out on the streets, held hands, lit candles, sang kumbaya. And then they went home, patted themselves on the back. It was a massive act of self-gratification, and that was it. It failed. There's no sustaining it. There wasn't demonstration after demonstration after demonstration. Each demonstration was an event like a carnival. Let's have a demonstration. Let's have freedom of speech. Let's go home. Let's get back onto our lives. And let's do nothing while the nation marches towards war. And now we're in war, and we're heading toward another war. But the difference is, with Iran, there's not even an acknowledgement in America that we're going to be at war in the near future, that we are at war today. Where is the peace movement today? Where are the massive demonstrations? Everybody's focused in on the past, as they should be. Iraq is a travesty. Iraq is a tragedy. Iraq needs to be dealt with. But Iraq is also a distraction to what's going on in Iran. And if you blink your eyes long enough, we're going to be at war in Iran. If you wait long enough, there'll be American forces marching out of Azerbaijan to the outskirts of Tehran, hoping to encourage the Iranian people to rise up against the mad mullahs. This is the direction we're heading. What can we do? I think it's time that we have to acknowledge, we have to accept that we lost the opening battle. And we're going to pay a heavy price for this defeat. This is like our Pearl Harbor. We took a big hit, and it's going to take us some time to dig out of this one. We have to recognize that the thing that defines who we are and what we are as a people, the Constitution of the United States, that document that embodies us as a nation based on the rule of law, is not widely embraced by the American people. It's not even widely understood by the American people, and there rests the problem. How can you hold the President of the United States accountable for violating the Constitution of the United States of America when Americans don't understand what the Constitution is? Therefore, they can't be cognizant of the fact that he's violated it. The peace movement wants to do anything. It has to start at the grassroots, not bashing Bush, but teaching Americans about what it means to be an American, about who we are and what we are as a people. Throw politics aside. I don't care if you're a liberal Democrat or a conservative Republican. If you call yourself an American, that means that you have embraced the Constitution, because that is what an American is. A citizen of the United States of America is somebody who has sworn an oath of allegiance to that document, to the words, to the ideals of that document. And right now we have citizens who don't even understand what that document is, couldn't cite you any verbiage from that document. But they could damn sure tell you what the newest PlayStation 2 game is. They can tell you what's on TV, what the commercials are, what the movies are. We've stopped being a nation of citizens, and instead we've become a nation of consumers. And this consumerism is killing this country. This consumerism allows Americans to be exploited by having their addiction to this lifestyle hung out on one hand and citizenship held out on the other hand. And when given a choice, we choose consumerism. We choose the lifestyle. We choose the easy path, a path made easier by the powers that be. And we drop citizenship. How long will it take America to relearn citizenship? A long time. I talk, in my assessment, in terms of 3 to 4 national election cycles. That's 4 years per election cycle. That's 12 to 16 years. That may seem like a long time to us today, and it is. In terms of history, it's a drop in the bucket. How long did it take the United States to deal with the issue of slavery that tore our country apart? Decades. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we face a crisis of citizenship today that is as grave as the crisis of slavery faced by our country over 100 years ago. And we're going to have to deal with it by getting back to the fundamentals. It doesn't mean we're going to fight a civil war, but it does mean that we're going to have that kind of, I don't want to get religious, but in the Marine Corps we call it a come-to-Jesus moment, you know, where you get down and you say, what is it all about? Who are we and what are we? And who we are and what we are Americans defined by the Constitution that created this country. And if you build that foundation, from that, great things can happen. It doesn't mean that great things happen for the progressive community. It doesn't mean great things happen for the conservative community. It means great things happen for this country. Go back and study history. John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, conservative, liberal. Guys didn't like each other. They fought all the time. They had ideas that were like night and day. But they had a process of the rule of law, debate, discussion, dialogue. And they engaged in that process. And from that engagement came compromises that formed this great nation. And that's where we need to be heading, to a nation where we have tolerance of diverse ideas, so long as those ideas are put forward in a manner consistent with the rule of law set forth by the Constitution. But we cannot survive as a nation of citizens when we have hatred, we have intolerance, when we have a complete disregard for the rule of law. How can you expect a citizen to stand up and defend the Constitution when those whom we elect to higher office are so dismissive of the Constitution? The citizens aren't even aware of what's going on. What can the peace movement do? Dig in for the long campaign, ladies and gentlemen. This is a huge fight for the future of America. And it's not going to be won overnight. It's not going to be won in a week. It's not going to be won in a month. It's not going to be won in a year. This is a decades-long struggle. But if we don't fight this struggle, and if we don't persevere in this struggle, the America that my children are going to grow up into as adults may be called the United States of America, but it won't be the United States of America. It'll be something completely different. And frankly speaking, it'll be a country that I wouldn't give my life for, and I wouldn't expect anybody to give their life for. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Scott Ritter, an ex-Marine intelligence officer and chief UN weapons inspector, who spoke on June 23rd at the Trap Rock Peace Center in Deerfield, Massachusetts. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, or WZKW Kingsville. This is Unwelcome Guests. We continue with Scott Ritter in dialogue with his audience.
So as predicted, you have many, many questions. And if you wrote three on your card, I'm only going to read one. I'm sorry. We'll have to have you back, Scott. Could Iran have... I'm going to read a series of questions about Iran. And please choose what you feel you can answer most importantly. Could Iran have a nuclear energy and a nuclear weapons program? What is the possibility of an overwhelming Republican defeat in the 2006 congressional elections to obstruct further attacks on our Constitution, as we are seeing with Iran? Are the MEK members going to install a revolutionary type of government that will be an excuse for increased violence, U.S. violence? Do you think that the U-2 that crashed in the Middle East a few days ago was shot down by the Iranians? For many reasons, the Iraqi army melted away from combat in 03. I don't believe the Iranian army will behave similarly in the event of a U.S. invasion. They will fight. Iran is a very large, mountainous, for the most part, country. Does the U.S. have the same prospects of success as it did in 03? I'm not sure what success means, I'm afraid. Another question on the MEK. Is the MEK Sunni, Shia? What exactly is their role in Iraq, Lebanon? Who do they answer to? Armitage? Pakistan? Robert D. Kaplan has written that to young Iranians, the most admired person in the country is the son of the Shah, who lives in exile in the U.S. Do you agree with this? How does this affect our current situation? And... and so many questions. And a question about, I'm not evaluating any of the questions, just offering all of them. Can you comment on the situation at the U.S. Air Force Academy? Do you really think the above struggle can be conducted without a civil war with the Christian right?
Can we pause there?
Yes, that's all that's said on Iran, and you can have them for reference. Yours is in there, too? This one? One last one from our... In the middle? Find it, please.
If you're the cook, you get special dinner.
Yes. Another round of applause for the cook, David Deshevsky. Do you feel that there is a connection between the current buildup in Iran and an existing U.S. idea to pump oil through Azerbaijan and Georgia, and a failure to find a source for Caspian oil despite the multinationals beginning to build the pipeline? So a whole lot of questions.
Well, this It's a good way to find out what my ability to memorize things are. Normally, you do little acronyms. You know, you put the words together, and, you know, come up with the deer crosses the road. So let me come to the T, the MEK. The MEK is a Marxist organization. They're not Sunni. They're not Shia. They're not religious. They're basically Marxist ideologues, students primarily when they started the movement in 1979. And they reject the dictatorship of the Ayatollah Khomeini and the dictatorship of the theocrats, the mullahs in Tehran. That's why they went to Iraq, where they worked on behalf of Saddam Hussein. They don't work for Armitage. They don't work for... The MEK's sole function is to overthrow the mullahs in Tehran. The likelihood of the United States allowing the MEK to achieve political power in Iran once the mullahs are overthrown is slim to none. The MEK is a tool that's being used, and when this sad course of events is run its course, the MEK will be shunted aside and somebody else will come in. Robert Kaplan speaks of the son of Reza Shah Pahlavi being the most admired man in Iran. I think that is absurd. Robert Kaplan may claim to be a student of history, but if he was a real student of history, he would understand that one of the most hated men in Iran is Reza Shah Pahlavi. The reason why the Ayatollah Khomeini was able to come to power the way he did, the reason that there is this Islamic fundamentalism in Iran today is because of the multi-decades-long reign of terror run by the Shah of Iran. SAVAK, his intelligence organization, is hated in Iran because of the torture centers that they ran. And SAVAK, as every Iranian knows, was trained by the CIA. The Shah of Iran was a close ally of the United States of America. So the notion of the United States making joint cause with the son of Reza Shah Pahlavi and moving into Iran and having the people of Iran rise up in the streets and embrace him is, I'd like to say it was drug-induced fantasy, but then that gave him an excuse. But it has to be based upon pure ideology because it's not responsible analysis. There's no way that I could begin to support any notion of the son of Reza Shah Pahlavi being a most admired person in Iran. Okay, the question about the buildup in Iran, the existing idea to pump oil through Azerbaijan and Georgia and the failure to find a source in the Caspian Sea. Look, I know that it's popular to blame George Bush for everything. It feels good right now. There's a lot of frustration that exists, but the concept of a major oil reservoir in the Caspian Sea isn't about ideology or politics. It's about business. And there are many, many oil companies who have invested billions and billions of dollars into the notion of this being there. You don't build a pipeline for politics. You build a pipeline for business. Oil companies don't invest in pipelines to please a politician. They invest in pipelines to pump oil and make money, which pleases politicians. But you've got to put the money first. There is some politics involved in the pipeline that goes from Azerbaijan through Georgia into the Black Sea. It's a stupid pipeline, if you think about it, because you can't put it in the supertankers because the supertankers can't force the Dardanelles, the Bosphorus. It was done because we will not allow a pipeline to be built through Iran. I believe your question is, now that we realize that there's not this big reservoir, that this pipeline is a stupid idea, that it's not going to function, that the real oil is in Iran, is this buildup about getting to the real oil?